Good morning, everybody. Let me start the second lecture and let me start reviewing what we have done yesterday. So in particular, we discussed the relativistic objects. And so we can have more dimensional objects than just particles. And these more dimensional objects are called p-brains. So a p-brain is something which sweeps a p plus one dimensional trajectory in the space-time. So in particular, you would have a particle which sweeps a line in the space-time. And so that would be a zero brain. But then you can have a string, which would be a one brain, and so on. So this is how it looks like. So I have t, and then I will have spatial directions in my space-time. And then I have, for example, a string which moves in the space-time and sweeps this trajectory in there. And of course, the trajectory is fully described by telling, you know, how the coordinates in the space-time look like as a function of some parameter. So if you have one parameter, it describes line. If you have two parameters, it describes a sheet, and so on. So you can think about these parameters as coordinates on the world sheet of the object. So for example, if you had a particle, you would have psi a would be just lambda, and then you would have so you can think about the parameter lambda in that sense as a coordinate which characterizes the motion of the particle. And then, of course, the dependence x mu of lambda tells you where the particle is. Okay, so that's how you describe relativistic objects which are more dimensional. So now the simplest case is, of course, when these objects are actually free objects. They are not subject to any force, in which case their motion is governed by the Nambu-Goto type of action. And so what this action really is that you take the volume of this worksheet, you take the volume of this sheet here, and you try to extremize that. And it's similar to, you know, what we were doing for the particle. We were extremizing the proper time. So here, we are extremizing the proper volume of this object. Okay, and so the way how you do it is, of course, you need to write down the formula for the volume of this worksheet. And so the first thing is that you calculate the so-called induced metric on this worksheet. And so it's a metric induced by the Minkowski metric. So Minkowski metric has to enter the formula. And then, of course, I have eta mu nu. I have to kill the indices, eta mu nu. So these are my spatial coordinates. I'm killing them. I'm summing over mu and nu here. And these are my new indices, which will be like the metric induced on this type of sheet. And so these are the internal indices on the sheet, A and B. So again, they run from 0 to P. And so you can really think about this as a P plus 1 dimensional metric on that sheet. Okay. So once you have that induced metric, then the magic formula for the volume is simply take the determinant of the metric. And because the metric actually has one time direction, typically, because our object moves in time as well. So that will be negative. So that's why I'm putting a minus sign here. And then you take square root of that. And that's your action, the Nambu-Goto action. And you just have to extremize this. And of course, that yields some equations of motion, which are simple for particles. They are just these geodesic equations, d square x mu over d tau square equals to 0. But for strings, this is more complicated, and for other objects, even more complicated. All right, so now, really specifically, I can choose a particle, which will be psi a, will be just one parameter lambda, in which case, this induced metric, I have now only one parameter here, so I differentiating x mu with respect to lambda. And this is my induced metric. Of course, in this case, it doesn't have any indices, right? Because I have only one parameter lambda. You can call it gamma lambda lambda if you want. So I could equally write here gamma lambda lambda. And it's given by that. But of course, this is a scalar. So if I take a determinant of that, determinant of a scalar is the same thing. So that's why I'm putting here this is my determinant of gamma lambda lambda, and it's this thing here. And then, you know, what I was writing here is proportional. So typically, you know, people put here the tension of the string, tension on the brain, and whatever. But for particle, it's simply the mass. And so what stands in front of this is just minus m0 c square. Okay, and so that's the standard action for the point particle. And you see it's just a special case of this action here. Yes?
Okay, I don't understand very well the meaning of the physical meaning of the B-brain. For the zero brain, I understand that it is just a particle moving in one dimension of space-time.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it is like a particle moving in more than one dimension.
No, so this one here, for example, you have a string. So at any given instant of time, okay, let's say this is a string, right? So at any given instant of time, it has a dimension of length, well, here. But now it moves in space-time. So as it moves, it sort of sweeps the trajectory like that in time.
But what is
right?
String, physically speaking?
What is string?
Yeah.
Well, string is a string, right? So here we are describing a fundamental relativistic object, which simply, you know, is characterized by its tension. So you can have, yeah.
Classical mechanics, or?
Yeah, you can think about it like that, for example. So, yeah.
But is there any other physical meaning?
Well, of course, you know, this is precisely how the relativistic strings in string theory are described. So this will be the fundamental string of string theory.
And why would we need these strings?
Well, they are simply objects which can exist in the nature, right? And even in general relativity, you have string-like objects, like cosmic strings. And they certainly, you know, could have been created in the early universe as topological defects coming from some phase transitions. And so in that case, you would describe those cosmic strings precisely by the same mass here. So even if you don't care about string theory, you know, but you care about maybe some little bit beyond standard model of physics in the early universe, then you would have cosmic strings, and they would be precisely described by this type of action. Okay, please be skeptical of string theory. That's fine with me. All right. So we have this type of action. But you see immediately that there are two problems with this action, and you already discussed that in your tutorial. So this action is super nice. It has very nice geometrical meaning. The geometrical meaning is simply extremize, you know, the volume of this sheet, or extremize the length of the line and whatever. So it has a nice geometrical meaning. But it has also problems, and so the first problem is that obviously here this only works for massive particles, so works only for massive particles when m0 is non-trivial. And obviously, if I set m0 equal to 0, then the whole thing vanishes, and I've screwed up. And second thing, it's quite complicated. And it's complicated because it has this square root here. So it's complicated. Namely, it has the square root. So for classical physics, it's not a problem, of course. It's the simplest way how you can get to a geodesic equation. But if you want to start quantizing things, well, people don't know how to quantize square roots. In fact, people only know how to quantize harmonic oscillators. So you need something which is quadratic in your fields, right? So you need something like phi square or nabla phi square. And then you can quantize that. But how do you quantize square root of that, right? So in other words, if you do a pass integral, you only know how to do Gaussian integrals. But this is certainly not a Gaussian integral. If I do exponential of this action, it's not a Gaussian integral. So this is certainly a problem for quantizing. For quantization. And so that's why there's this, you know, extremely useful other action, which you discussed in your tutorial yesterday, and that's the Polyakov type action, which basically makes this action quadratic in the fields. So instead, can consider Polyakov action instead. And Polyakov action is basically, it looks almost like a free field theory, but there's a price to pay, and the price you have to pay is that you introduce another field. Okay, so this for a particle, the Polyakov action, which you've seen yesterday, just looks like this. It's an integral 1 over e eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda, and then minus 0 square e d lambda. Okay, so that's the Polyakov type of action for a point particle. And you see that this action is super nice if you look at the fields x mu as a function of lambda. So this is really quadratic action in x mu. And so that's why, you know, corresponding path integral will be Gaussian, and that's why you can actually quantize this. So this looks like harmonic oscillator, and so we can quantize it. But of course, there is a price to pay, and the price to pay is that we introduce another field. Price to pay is introduced extra field, and this is E as a function of lambda. Okay, so now we have basically fields x mu, and then we have field E and field E here. Okay, so that's fine. But you know, this is a special field, as I was trying to stress yesterday in the tutorial. So whereas your action typically depends on the field and the derivatives of the field, this action certainly depends, well, it doesn't depend on x mu. It will eventually, when this will be a curved metric, but it depends on x dot here. So with respect to x coordinate, this is a perfectly valid nice action. However, with respect to field E, you see that there are no derivatives of E with respect to lambda. So what it means is that this extra field actually, because there are no E dots anywhere, this is a Lagrange multiplier. So this is a Lagrange multiplier. So no dE over d lambda anywhere. And so, in principle, you can always integrate out the Lagrange multipliers. So this action, as I said, is an action for E and for x mu. But now I can vary the action with respect to E. So the variation with respect to E just gives me that formula which you found yesterday, that E is 1 over m0 square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. And if you plug it back, so I do variation with respect to E. That's my Euler-Lagrange equation. I find E from there. And then if you plug that, plug back, you go back to Nambu-Gotoi's recovered. Okay, so that's what you have done yesterday. And so it basically shows that classically this action is equivalent to that action here. So indeed, this action will give the same geodesic equation. All right, so this is good. So actions are classically equivalent. Actions are classically equivalent. And another advantage which you discovered yesterday in your tutorial as well is that Moreover, in this action, it's actually super simple to take the limit m0 goes to 0. Moreover, we can take m0 equals to 0 limit, in which case this term goes away, and I'm just left with this one here. But E is a function of lambda, and I integrate over the lambda, so I can change the parameter lambda to actually absorb this E into it. So basically, effectively setting E equal to 1. So then we get an action for massless particles. Massless. And it will simply be given, well, okay, C squared over 2, and then eta mu nu dx mu over d lambda dx nu over d lambda. And so this will be an action for massless particles. And for example, if you treat light as massless particle, you can recover it from the Polyakov action as well. Okay, so that's super nice about this Polyakov action, that really it solves many problems at once. It gives you a right prescription for massless particles, but it also, you know, allows you to basically write it in such a nice form that you can actually start quantizing that. All right, yes?
If we take this action, if we consider the Hamilton function, then for photons, we have always zero, right?
So see, this one no longer is reparametrization invariant. I'm not sure if the Hamiltonian is zero. I would have to check. I don't know. I don't know. So certainly here, this action is reparametrization invariant. So if I change lambda to some lambda tilde, nothing, the form of the action does not change. It will still be the same. So that's why it tells you the Hamiltonian will be zero. But here, this is no longer true, right? If I change lambda to lambda tilde, I have two of them here. So that will actually modify. I'll go basically back to this 1 over E here. And I'm not sure. All right. So let me just write how the Polyakov action looks for a string, if you are interested in string theory. Okay. So Polyakov action. Polyakov action for a string and the statement is that the action now is proportional to, so now string is just two-dimensional, so it's d square of xi, and so then it's square root of minus h hab gamma ab. Okay, so this is the action for the string, which is considered in string theory. So now we already know what gamma AB is. That's the induced metric as above. Induced metric. And so HAB is some auxiliary metric. This is some auxiliary metric, and H is its determinant. So H is determinant of HAB. Okay, so this is how the action looks like. And if you look at that and compare with whatever we had here for the particle, it's obvious that we don't have the second term. So the massive term here is not present. All we have is the first term here, this one. This is just gamma lambda lambda. And this is basically square root of h and h alpha b, h ab. So this thing here, you can think about these two objects as 1 over e. And we had the gamma ab there. But we don't have the massive term. So this is absent. So this describes a massless string. So the string is massless. Because we don't have the extra M0 term there. All right, so that's that. So now, maybe you have seen, maybe not, how the action for a scalar field look like. So the note that if you had a scalar field, so scalar field action. So if you have a scalar phi, then your action would simply look like, so S of phi, well, it's an integral. So let's say in D dimensions, it's an integral d, okay, let's call these dimensions y. Why not? D dy, and okay, let's call them psi. D d psi, and then you would have minus 1/2, and then you would have minus 1/2, and then nabla phi square plus other terms, plus the potential if you want. But what is really, you know, so this would be in flat space. So in flat space, you just have the integration over the coordinates, and then this would be a derivative with respect to the xi coordinate, and then you would just have nabla phi square. Of course, if I want in the curve space, then you just have to use the correct metric to contract the indices of nabla. So this is what this is really is like in flat space, it's just eta mu nu, nabla mu, nabla nu, or whatever. So now I just have to replace eta with the corresponding metric, which let's say it's curve metric. So in curve space, and let's say that the curvature, the metric in the curve space is actually HAB. HAB is the curve metric. So if that is the case, then the action for phi actually is d d psi, and then you have to include the square root of g, square root of minus h, where h is the determinant of that metric, and then you would have minus 1/2 h a b nabla a phi nabla b phi, as we will see later. So if you haven't seen this, don't worry about that. So this is how an action for a scalar field phi would look like in curve space, where the curvature is caused by this metric HAB. Okay. So now, if you look at that action there, what do we really have there? Okay, so now look at the string action. And so what do we have there? We have S, which is proportional to moving super slowly. So it's proportional to D square of xi minus H. And then we have HAB. Okay, and then we have gamma AB. Well, what is gamma AB? So gamma AB is this guy here. So it's eta mu nu dx mu dxi a dx nu dxi b. Okay? So what this gamma ab is, let's just plug it there. Okay, so first, so it is eta mu nu, and then dx mu over dxi a. But dx mu over dxi a is like a gradient with respect to coordinate a. So let me just write it as nabla a of xi mu. So it's nabla a of x mu, and then nabla b of x mu. Okay, so that's what it is. I'm just using this a, meaning that it's actually derivative with respect to xi a. All right, so now let me expand this. Okay, so what is this guy here? Well, eta mu nu is the flat metric, so it's just minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. So what this really is, I don't know, minus, if I choose mu and nu equal to 0, so it's minus nabla a x 0, nabla b x0, and then it's plus the spatial components. So it's plus nabla a, x1, nabla b, x1, plus other coordinates here. Okay, so a miracle now happens, right? So if you look at this here, and if you look at that here, so of course, apart from 1/2, which anyway, I was writing proportional, so what is written really here is just an action for a scalar field x0 with minus sign, and then an action for a scalar field x1 with plus sign, and x2 with plus sign, and so on. So this is like, okay, if you are in four dimensions, Adam Unu is four dimensional, so this is like four scalar fields x mu, which are functions, okay. And then this is d square xi. So actually, the scalar fields, they live in two dimensions. Okay, four scalar fields x mu that live in 2D. Okay, so basically you can look at the string action, well, in the way that it is nothing else than just, you know, four, if you are in four dimensions, or 10, if you are in 10 dimensions, scalar fields x mu, so the coordinates now are the scalar fields that live in 2D. So we have two-dimensional free field theory, so there's no potential for these scalar fields, it's just a kinetic term, okay? So now the scalar field theory in two dimensions is super nice. And it's super nice because it has a conformal symmetry. So in 2D, free scalar field has conformal symmetry. If you don't know what that is, don't worry. Basically, I can rescale the metric and the action doesn't change. So I have a conformal symmetry. And so basically, that's the origin of what you are really describing here is 2D CFT. And that's the origin of all the nice properties of string theories, that you enjoy the conformal symmetry. Okay, that's true classically. If you demand this is true also quantum mechanically, you actually derive Einstein equations from there. Okay, so this is super, super nice. And it's what is also super, super nice is that this is only true in 2D. So if you had a free scalar field in any other dimension, the conformal symmetry is lost. And so, you know, higher dimensional objects will not enjoy these nice properties. The strings are really special in that because they live in two dimensions. The worksheet is two-dimensional, and that's why you have CFT. Okay, so if you don't care about string theory, just don't care about this. Just remember out of this is that for a particle, which is the mostly, you know, the subject of general relativity, you can write two types of actions. One is the Nambu-Goto type of action, which has the square root, and it's super nice, and you know it leads to geodesic equation immediately. On the other hand, it has problems, and the Polyakov action actually solves these problems. Okay, and so then you can recover the action for massless particles as well, and that does not have the square. Okay, questions? That was an exposure to string theory. All right, so let me stop overview of special relativity here, and let me start general relativity. So basically what happens is that we understand all the physics apart from gravitational fields. At this point, we understand electromagnetism, we understand how to include, you know, how to extend this to mechanics, we know how to treat particles, we know how to treat these objects here, but all we are missing at this point is gravitational field. So the rest of the course will be how to include the gravitational field. So chapter number two will be first look at general relativity. And so what we really want to do is that we want to include gravitational fields. Okay, so that's our goal. And so let me do it, like I really want to do a little bit of philosophy here. So part A, it's called conceptual paths. Theory. And so basically, let's pretend now that we are Einstein and we are trying to develop the theory for gravitational field. And it's a very difficult task. I already told you that it took Einstein a couple of months to figure out special relativity, but it took him 10 years to actually, you know, make sense of gravitational theory of the general relativity. Also, you know, what is certainly true about special relativity is that if Einstein wasn't born, then we would have special relativity maybe not on Monday 1905, but maybe on Friday 1905. Okay, so many people were working on special relativity, many people were almost there, like Lorentz, Poincaré, and these people. So, you know, if Einstein wasn't born, we certainly would have special relativity. And it was just a matter of time, a matter of months, maybe, before it was actually written down. However, it's very questionable whether this would be true for general relativity. So Einstein basically himself was working on this 10 years, and if he wasn't born, maybe we wouldn't have general relativity until now. Okay, so it's really something which required a true genius. So let's just, you know, try to pretend that we can follow his thoughts, what was happening, you know, between 1905 and 1915. And so basically he had like two key ideas, what he's actually looking for. So he had ingredient number one. Of course, what he was looking for is something which is a gravitational theory which is consistent with special relativity. Okay, so consistent field theory of gravity. Sorry, that's not right. So, okay, what I want to say is that's consistent with special relativity. Is special relativity well, what it means is that in particular in Newton's theory you have to actually remove the action at a distance, right? So action at a distance doesn't make any sense in Minkowski space. If you have the causal structure as we discussed yesterday of the light cone, then, you know, if you have action at a distance, there is no 3D simultaneity surface. So you know, not everything on this 3D simultaneity surface actually knows about the object here, but it would have to be, you know, you just cannot make sense of the action at a distance. So in particular, get rid of action at a distance. Okay, and so what he basically wanted to do is that, well, maybe the idea was, I know that the Maxwell theory, which is nice and whatever, is a nice field theory, and it has a nice static limit. So remind you what happened. So Einstein was in love with Maxwell theory. So in the Maxwell theory, we discussed in the front end, Maxwell theory. We know that the fields in the full theory, we have the fields which are the vector potentials, which are phi and a, which can be combined into a mu. Okay, so that's what the fields are in Maxwell theory. And if you write down the Maxwell equations, then you know that there's a freedom in these fields. There's this gauge freedom, and that allows you to write down the Lorentz gauge condition. So the Maxwell equations are actually box on A mu is minus 4 pi J mu. That's the field equations, but these are only valid if you have Lorentz gauge. So D mu A mu equals to zero. So that's your Maxwell theory. And of course, this is also accompanied by the equation of motion, which is nothing else than dp mu over d tau. Or let me just write it in 3D notation, dp over dt is e times e plus v cross b. Okay, so that's the equation of motion here. So now, if you look at the Maxwell's theory, you can look at its static limit or electrostatic limit. So let's now consider electrostatic limit. Static limit. So what it means is that basically you have only static charges. You don't have any currents, and you don't have time dependence of fields. Okay, so that means A is zero, the vector potential A is zero, and that means dt derivatives will also give you zero. Okay, so now if you look at the electrostatic limit, then of course if you don't have basically any currents or whatever, well, this is gone. The only field that you are left is phi. So this only makes sense for the first component, and this box operator, which is minus dt square, will go away, plus Laplace on A is equal to something, but only part of A left is phi. So then this thing reduces to Laplace on phi is minus 4 pi rho. Okay, so that's the electrostatic limit of this equation. What about this equation? What do you think? Do we get anything out of that equation? Of course, this is dt of phi, which is zero, plus divergence of A. A is zero, so this is automatically satisfied. So this one is automatically satisfied, and we don't get any constraint from there. So this is all we get in electrostatics. Of course, in electrostatics, the equation of motion here is just dp over dt. Magnetic field is zero, and E is minus gradient of phi. So it's minus E gradient of phi. And that's your Maxwell theory in the electrostatic limit. Okay, so now this is what Einstein knew. And then he looked at what is known about Newton's theory. Okay, so compare this. Compare to Newton. And so, of course, everybody knows Newton's law is that the force is mm over r square or something like that, gmm over r square. But of course, you can write Newton's theory in the way Laplace did. And so he basically introduced a Newton's potential phi m. So introducing Newton's potential phi Newton, then what you can actually show is that the Newton's theory and the Newton's force law actually takes the form Laplace on phi Newton is equal to 4 pi gravitational constant, Newton's gravitational constant, density of matter. And if you write down the force law, you find that it's dp over dt equals to minus m Laplace of phi. So this is the Newton's theory in the language of Laplace, which was known to Einstein because it was developed in 19th century. Okay, so now you compare, so this is the Newton's theory. So now you compare the two and you see that they are exactly the same thing, apart from the fact that now we have gravitational constant here. Well, and then you have density of matter instead of density of charge. And then you have a different charge here. You have electric charge here. And the mass is the gravitational charge corresponding to, well, this thing here. Okay, so then it was clear to Einstein that what he is actually looking for is basically like a Maxwell theory for gravitational field. Okay, so can we actually extend these equations, which are like electrostatic limit, to the full equations of Maxwell? So can so the ingredient was one was, can we write Maxwell like theory for gravity? So that was the first question, which was, you know, immediate to Einstein. So of course we know that Maxwell theory is consistent with special relativity. It's finite speed of propagation. Everything works. So, you know, if you can write Maxwell-like theory for gravity, you will solve the problem that it's not consistent with relativity. Okay, so that was the ingredient number one. However, it's more complicated than that. So, you know, the key question is, can I just write another field theory which lives in flat space as the Maxwell theory does? Or is gravity anyhow special? And I actually cannot do that. And so it took Einstein some time to realize that you cannot do that. And gravity is indeed special, as we will see in a minute. So now ingredient number two was really Einstein was started thinking about the notions of space and the notions of motion, and, you know, what is if gravity is anyhow special, or if I can just write another field theory in flat space. All right, so ingredient number two was from relativity of motion, okay? And so basically, what was, throughout the history of physics, there were two concepts of what space might be and what motion might be. One concept is that of Newton, that there exists an absolute space, which is completely independent of what's happening in that space. So simply the space is there. The other notion is that everything is relative. So historically, people understood space either as entity, absolute entity, which, you know, is there no matter what. And the other one was that it's basically a relation between, you know, objects which live in that space. So if you have absolute space there, then it really makes sense to say, well, particle travels from this point of the absolute space to that point of the absolute space. If you assume that space is actually a relation, it only makes sense to say, you know, I have a motion of this particle with respect to that particle, or a motion of this field with respect to that field. It's always a relative motion of something. So adjacency. Relation between objects so similar to what happened almost with everything, this correct view was done much earlier than the wrong view. So the correct view was already assumed by Greeks. Ancient Greeks like Aristotle and whatever. And of course, this is deep, dark medieval times of Newton. Okay. Okay, and so really, you know, it's always like step back if you go to to medieval times. So now this is interesting, right? So already, you know, 2,000 years ago, people thought this is the right point of view. So what made Newton to actually switch to the absolute space? And so he has this thought experiment, or actually a true experiment of Newton's bucket. So let me just review that argument of Newton. So Newton introduced, so he was not happy with that, but in the end he did introduce the absolute space. Absolute space based on the following experiment. Following experiment, which is called Newton's bucket experiment. Newton's bucket experiment. Okay, so it could be like the first theoretical abstract concept of an experiment, apart from the fact that you can actually do this experiment easily. All right, so what is this Newton's bucket experiment? So imagine you have a rope and you have a bucket. You fill the bucket with water, and then you curl the rope and then release it, and so the rope and the bucket start rotating, and then later on the water starts rotating as well. Okay, so let's say at t equal to zero, we have the configuration that this is our bucket here, and it's full with water, but now we already rotate the rope and we rotate the bucket, but the water, because we just started, is still there. Okay, so the water here is still, water is still, and the bucket and the rope rotate. And then the bucket rotates. Okay, so that's when you release the rope, the bucket already rotates like that, but the water still. So then later on, of course, there's friction in water. And so later on, the water starts rotating as well. Okay, so later, you have now configuration where both the bucket and the water rotates. And you know that if the water rotates, it actually creates a concave surface. Okay, so now we have the bucket rotates. The water rotates. And we observe a concave surface. Okay, so this is just based on an experiment or based on your everyday experience here. And so now Newton uses this experiment to actually argue that there must be an absolute space. So he argues, if these stupid Greeks are right, and really what matters is the relationship between objects, okay, then I should be observing, you know, if the motion is relative, then I should be observing strange things when actually objects move with respect to each other. However, in this case, we observe the water, nothing strange is happening with the water, it's just flat, okay? But there is a relative motion between the bucket and the water. Water is still, the bucket rotates, so I should be observing some strange things. There is a relative motion of the two objects, okay? But we don't observe anything special. In this case, he says, well, the water rotates and the bucket rotates, so there is no relative motion between the two objects, okay? So how come I observe a strange concave surface? Okay, and then he says, well, this relationship definition of space doesn't make any sense. It must be the rotation of the water in this case with respect to the absolute space. In this case, the water is not moving, it's just to the absolute space. That's why I don't observe anything interesting. In this case, it does rotate with respect to the absolute space. That's why I see concave surface. Okay, so we see the existence of the absolute space. Okay. Of course, everybody hated him for this. Nobody liked the idea of absolute space, especially people like Leibniz, who already had some quarrel with Newton and many other. They just, you know, they knew that the absolute space notion is not correct, and this one is. But they couldn't defeat this argument, especially because of the practical success of Newton's theory, right? So he introduces absolute space, and then he formulated his laws. And then everything agreed with the experiment, right? Everything worked very well.
I think that it is in another direction, that he first...
It's true, it's not in the first first edition. It's in the, well, okay, it's in the second one. You're right, absolutely right. Yeah.
First, and then he needed space, absolute space, to have a correct...
That's right, but the theory is complete with the absolute space, right? You need an absolute space to complete the theory. And so this is the argument for the existence of the absolute space. So now, you know, people didn't like that, people hated it, but it took actually 300 years for people to actually defeat this argument. So it took 300 years to find what's wrong with that argument. Until Mach came. So Mach was a famous philosopher of the day, of the beginning of the 20th century. He was not a physicist, but he said, well, maybe this is not really a proof of the existence of the absolute space. Maybe the motion is still relative, but maybe the motion of water is not with respect to the absolute space, but it's a motion with respect to some matter content of the universe. Maybe the universe it contains lots of stars and stuff like that, and in this case, the water rotates with respect to the stars. In this case, it doesn't, so I don't see anything wrong. So Mach, this is a motion with respect to the matter content of the universe. Of the universe, so in particular, with respect to the distant stars. Okay, so that was the Max argument that, you know, there need not be absolute space. It's just I have, you know, universe which is filled with matter, and just, you know, this motion with respect to the content, with respect to this matter, actually causes this effect here. Okay, so that was a great idea that, you know, finally some progress, you know, defeating maybe the absolute space is not necessary. And so there comes Einstein now. And so what he, of course, likes is the relative motion. Okay, so relative motion is great. What he doesn't like is the motion with respect to distant stars. That sounds like action at a distance, right? So he wants to get rid of that. So Einstein basically says, well, I like the relative, but I don't like the action at a distance thing. And so now he has to invent something new. You know, what does the water rotate with respect to, right? So Einstein, so he likes relative, but does not like, hates action at a distance. So it's a non-local interaction, basically. So, you know, in order this water to know about the distant stars, you know, there must be an instantaneous action. Okay, and so he comes with a new answer. It surprised everybody. He says, well, it must be a local interaction with something which is already here, locally. So the only thing which is here is the gravitational field. So now he says, it's the rotation with respect to the gravitational field. We have a gravitational field here, and a gravitational field here. The water here is static with respect to the gravitational field. That's why I don't see anything here. Whereas it's moving with respect, there's an inertial force with respect to the gravitational field. This has is the relative motion with respect to gravitational field. So now it's relative and local. But how can that be, right? Why the gravitational field? What is so special about gravitational field? And so, of course, this concavity of the surface is caused by some kind of inertial force. It's the centrifugal force, which is an inertial force. So what you are basically saying is that for inertial forces, what matters is the gravitational field. So in other words, maybe gravitational field sort of behaves like an inertial force. Okay, so what he actually now is thinking that maybe the acceleration or the inertial acceleration is something like gravitational force. So he starts thinking that. And if that is true, then the gravitational force actually tells you what is an inertial frame and what is not an inertial frame. I have to really, you know, measure now things with respect to the gravitational field. So gravity determines inertial frame. But if that is true, and if gravity determines inertial frame, then gravitational field theory will not be a theory in flat space. It actually, you will have to modify the notion of space. Okay? And so then, cannot have just another Maxwell-like theory, in flat space. Because flat space is what is responsible, you know, what tells you what the inertial frame is. But now if I have gravity, which sort of tells you what the inertial frame is, then you have to modify the notion of flat space. And so these two ingredients, so looking for Maxwell-like theory, which is not Maxwell-like theory because gravity is special, actually told Einstein what he needs to do. So then, you know, this happened, and I think it was 1908, I think. You can correct me if you know better. When he actually came with, he says, the most ingenious idea of his life, and that's the principle of equivalence and the idea of Einstein's elevator. Okay. Are there any questions to these two ingredients? Isn't this fun? God bless you. So, part B. No questions? Yes.
So, if you don't happen to be a genius, how do you know that, like, in a very inertial frame lies like non-flat space?
I'll try to. Okay, so what certainly you can conclude from here that the inertial acceleration has something to do with the gravitational force. So let's just continue what he was sort of saying, and maybe you will see it later. But I'm just saying this is really related to. Yeah. Okay. So then part B is the principle of equivalence. And that's really the heart of, which comes from this ingredient number two. And it's the heart of general relativity. And so, of course, everybody knows what principle of equivalence is. So if you learn high school physics, you know that the force is equal to ma. And if you are in uniform gravitational field, this is equal to mg. Okay. Well, this is perfect. So now, however, you write the same m here, and you write the same m here. this is super confusing because the different, you know, the meaning of this M is very different from the meaning of that M. The meaning of this M is the gravitational force, is the gravitational mass, and basically it tells you the response of the system to the gravitational field. On the other hand, this mass is the inertial mass. It's the inertial mass. And that tells you how difficult it is to accelerate the object. Okay, if I apply a force, how difficult it is to accelerate the object, precisely, you know, how big the mass is, 1 over m. Okay, so these are fundamentally different. But of course, people write m and m on the right-hand side, and they don't distinguish the two. So you know, what people do is that they say mi is equal to mg, and that agrees very well from the experience. So experience and experiments, that is true. And then, of course, what you have is that A equals to G. Okay, so what it means is that all objects in gravitational field have the same acceleration, so they fall the same way. So all objects, all bodies, in a given gravitational field experience the same acceleration. Okay, so that's what a principal equivalence is, that A equals to G, because MI equals to MG. All right, so as I said, this is a non-trivial statement that MI equals to MG, because you know they are simply two different, very, very different things. This is the response to the acceleration, this is the response to the gravitational field, why they should be the same. Okay, in fact, if you consider electromagnetism, you know, in the electrostatics, the force is E times E. Of course, E is something like G here. So this is the external field. So now we see that the charge E is certainly different from the initial mass M. So, you know, this will not be true in the electromagnetic case. It's only true in the case of gravity. Okay, so this is only true for electromagnetism. So for gravity, it's very different from the electromagnetism case. So now people measure this ratio mi over mg. They find it's equal to 1. Surprisingly, there is no really a theory which explains that it has to be so. Okay, so that's why, while Einstein doesn't try to explain this, just takes this as a fundamental principle, and then he derives his theory from here. Okay, so interestingly, as far as I know, the only theory which really explains that mi equals to mg is the Mach theory. Okay, so Mach, as I said, was a philosopher. He didn't know any physics, but then people took his ideas and then, you know, made a theory out of that, really a mathematical theory. And what they can show is that if you have sufficient amount of bodies in the universe, then mi has to be equal to mg. Okay, so that's basically the only theory I know of that explains that mi equals to mg. Of course, the theory is fundamentally wrong because it has action at a distance, but at least it gives us this prediction. Okay, so we have this. Any questions? So that's the principle of equivalence. That's a question in your interview, what a principle of equivalence is. So just remember this. The most important thing about general relativity. So now, a step from here, is, as I say, Einstein's most ingenious idea is the idea of Einstein's elevator. Einstein's elevator. Most ingenious idea of his life. As he puts it. And so he says, well, because A equals to G, I can mimic gravitational field with acceleration. Okay, so then if I have a guy in the elevator, and the elevator doesn't have any windows, so this is our guy. Okay, and if he doesn't have a window and is just closed in that elevator, and if the elevator actually accelerates upwards, where the acceleration is given by the value of g, this must be precisely equivalent to if I had an elevator on the surface of the Earth in the gravitational field g, where this is not accelerating. So that's the Einstein's elevator idea. So he says, if I have an acceleration, it must be the same as that if I am in gravitational field. Okay. So in other words, you know, the gravitational field can be mimicked by acceleration. So can mimic gravitational field by acceleration. Super simple idea, isn't it? Okay. So now, if you ask a modern physicist, Pedro, for example, he likes to say that, you know, modern physics is not about thinking about elevators, it's about doing hard calculations. Okay, so that's what Pedro says. I think it's not true. You'll see that this very simple idea of thinking about elevators actually basically yields all predictions of general relativity. Okay, just this very simple idea. So let me just show that. But you know, as an advice for you guys, sometimes it's actually good not to do calculations, but actually, you know, think about some elevators. Questions? Time? All right, so let me show how this idea of Einstein's elevator, for example, produces a, yes?
Why is your acceleration going up and one in the gravity?
Oh, so, you know, if you accelerate up, there's a like force down, right?
Okay.
So this is precisely what I want to mimic. Okay, so one of the consequences, the consequence number one, is the gravitational redshift. Okay, so let's assume that I'm in my elevator and I shoot a light starting from here upwards. Okay, so I send some frequency omega here and I shoot it upwards, and then I am in the gravitational field. So this is on the surface of the Earth. So I have the g here. Okay, and then I shoot a light upwards. Question is, if I, you know, send the light here with frequency omega, which frequency do I measure here? Do I measure omega or do I measure something else? Okay, because I'm asking, I probably measure something else. So the answer is I will measure omega prime here. So how do I show that omega prime is different from omega? Of course, by the principle of equivalence in Einstein's elevator, this must be completely equivalent to say that the two guys are actually in the moving elevator upwards. Okay, so then I have an elevator here, which accelerates upwards with the gravitational acceleration g. And then I shine the light here. Okay, but we know that the light actually propagates at the finite speed. Okay, so if the size of the elevator is delta h, then it takes light to basically get there. The time it takes is delta h over c. Okay, but in the time, of course, what happens with the elevator, it actually moves a little bit upwards. And if I start accelerating from zero velocity, as it moves upwards, it will have some non-trivial velocity v. Okay, so after this time, the elevator basically moves up a little bit. So now it will be here and there. OK. Okay, and so this distance here, of course, is 1/2 g t square, and it has the velocity here, and the velocity is g times t, where t is basically how long it takes for the light to travel upwards. Okay, so we have that c times t is the distance I have to travel is delta h plus 1/2 g t square. Okay, so this is the distance the light has to travel, and it's equal to c times t. So in other words, okay, this is super small. If the light travels really fast, if delta h is small, then this thing will be even smaller. Okay, so I can neglect this term here. I just set that equal to zero. So in which case I just have t is delta h over c. Okay, so then we have that the velocity of the elevator up here is just gt, which is t is delta h over c. So it's g delta h over c. That's the velocity of the observer up there. But now what is obvious is that, you know, this observer here is moving with the elevator upwards. So it's moving away from the light. Because it's moving away from the light, it will experience a Doppler shift. So the frequency measured by that observer will be smaller than the frequency here. Okay, so let's calculate what it is. So we experience Doppler shift. And what it means is that the frequency omega prime will be smaller than omega. So how do we calculate that? So we had a tutorial yesterday. So let's write the wave vector for the light shooting upwards. So you have the wave vector, so at the bottom, we have the wave vector k mu equals to omega over c 1, 0, 0, 1. Right? This is the z direction, and this is the time direction. So that's our wave vector of the light shooting upwards at the bottom. So shooting like upwards. Now, if we are up, we have a new wave vector k mu prime. Okay, that will be the new frequency omega prime over c, but it's still going upwards, so this is what it has to be. But I want this guy, you know, so this is as measured by the observer who is moving there. And so you showed yesterday in your tutorial that precisely this wave vector is sort of like I'm observing the same light, but now from a moving frame with the velocity v, this one here. So this experiences the Doppler shift. So this is the formula which you derived yesterday. It's gamma omega over c 1 minus beta 1, 0, 0, 1. This is what you derived yesterday. So this is the Doppler. And so in other words, of course, this is my omega prime. So my omega prime is just gamma omega 1 minus beta. That's how the frequency changes. Everything here is non-relativistic. G is super small. Delta H is super small. So gamma is 1. Okay, so this is something like omega 1 minus beta, and so beta is v, minus v over c. And all I have to do is I have to plug in what the velocity is from there. So this is omega 1 minus, and the velocity is g delta h c square, and that's it. So you see that indeed the frequency will be smaller, as predicted. So now people are interested in the redshift, which is like different between the two frequencies. So omega prime minus omega divided by omega. And so what it does is subtracts the one here. It just gives you this result here. So it just gives you minus g delta h over c squared. And that's your prediction for the gravitational redshift. As you shoot the light, you know, upwards. Okay. So that's the first prediction coming from the Einstein's elevator idea. Of course, now, you know, here comes experimentalists, so Pan and Repka. In 1960, and they actually play with the flashlight, and they have a tower which is 22 meters high, and they precisely measure this redshift. Okay, so in that case, what they could actually measure was 2.5 times 10 to minus 15. So this is what they measured for a tower delta h was something like 22 meters, and okay, so now I think one of these guys actually, well, okay. So they didn't get a Nobel Prize. I thought they did, but they didn't. But anyway, it's the first verification of general relativity. So when I ask you in the interview, what are the experimental tests of general relativity? This is one of them. Okay. So really, people could measure this. All right. So now, one more thing. Of course, you know that the frequency of light, well, you can sort of use it as your clock, right? So I just see what the frequency of the light is. And so then you would have delta, okay, the proper time will simply behave like 1 over omega, where it's the frequency of your light, okay? And so what it means is actually because the omega is changing, then your proper time goes differently in different points of the gravitational field. And so what you just predicted here is that actually if you are, you know, at the bottom here, your gravitation, your clock goes more slowly. So at the bottom. Bottom clock goes more slowly. Okay, so this is amazing, right? So the gravitational fields, strong gravitational fields, actually, you know, prolong your life. So another advice for you guys, not only you should be moving pretty fast because of the special relativistic effect, but you should also try to spend your time close to heavy objects producing lots of gravitational field, for example, in the library. Okay? So you can run fast in the library. Okay? Are there any questions? Okay, so that was the consequence number one. I have 5 minutes, right? No, I have 25. Okay, so let me just mention consequence number two, which is precisely how we get to the curved space. So consequence number two is, if you want light bending, but also prediction of curved space. Light bending or the existence of curved space. Okay, so that's another interesting prediction of general relativity. It says that the light will bend if it goes around a massive object. Okay, that's certainly... You have to really stretch Newton's theory, actually, for this to be true. Okay, so how does it go? Well, it's a simple consequence of, again, this principle of equivalence. So let's say this is my elevator. Okay. And then I have a hole here in that elevator, and I shoot a light here. Okay. So now I want to mimic what's happening in the gravitational field, so I let the elevator accelerate upwards. Okay, so this thing goes with the acceleration g. And so what, of course, happens is that the light travels in the straight line through my elevator. But now I have an observer inside that elevator who sees what's happening with that straight line curve. Okay, but what's happening is that, of course, the elevator is going up. So after some time, the elevator will be here. And so let's say the light is here then. So whereas it entered at time equal to zero, that high above the bottom of the elevator, later, when the bottom of the elevator is here, it's only that much above the bottom of the elevator. Or, and even later, the elevator will be here. Okay, there's too many lines. So let's say this one is red. Oh no, I did it again. I'm using color chalks. So this one is the original one. So anyway, so when I'm there, let's say the light is here, but now to the bottom of the elevator is only this far. So in other words, what I actually see for the observer who is inside is that the observer sees the light to do something like that, right? Because the light is actually curving while it's making smaller and smaller distance with respect to the bottom. Okay, so this is what, and then of course this must be the same thing as happens in the gravitational field. So then if you have a gravitational field, then the light will actually do this thing here. Right? Okay, so this is, you know, an immediate consequence of this is that, you know, the gravitational field actually curves things. So it actually tells you what a straight line is in a gravitational field, and it will not be normal straight line. It will be the curved straight line. So gravity changes. What it means for a path to be straight. Path to be straight Okay, and so from here, it's really very close step saying, well, it actually curves the space-time. Okay, so sort of curves space-time. So you basically, you know, in this case, you're saying, well, it's really actually in this frame, it's really straight line, but I don't see that straight line because of I'm accelerating upwards because I'm in the gravitational field. Okay, and so really the geometry sort of changes, right? So the straight line doesn't look straight anymore. So the geometry has to change. So that's why I have curved space time. All right, so questions? Yes?
Yes, I just want to ask, so if our last double arrow, that's the principle we're using, right?
So this is how I really see it if I'm, so this is what's happening. This is how I see it when I'm inside that elevator, which is accelerating upwards. And this is the equivalence principle. Yeah, thank you. Any other question? Okay, let me stop here, continue tomorrow.